Welcome to For the Long Run, the podcast exploring the why behind what keeps runners running long, strong, and motivated. I'm your host, Jonathan Levitt. Through personal and professional connections in the running world, I have the privilege of getting to know some amazing athletes. I've always been fascinated by the psychological aspect of running, and this podcast is aimed at exploring this and much more. I hope you enjoy. This episode is sponsored by Jonji. Jonji is a local to Boston running apparel company dedicated to exploring, connecting, and giving back through running. Inspired by travel, informed by function, and built for adventure, Jonji makes running essentials to equip you wherever you run or roam. The company was founded on the core belief that water is a human right and donates 2% of their sales to supporting clean water organizations around the world. I've known the two co-founders of Jonji for over 5 years, and it's been a privilege to see them grow and increase the level at which they've been able to give back to the running community and to the world in general. Welcome back. I have Nick De La Rosa joining me today. Nick, thanks so much for taking some time to chat here.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. Wonderful to be with you guys.
For sure. So first question, it's a tough one. Who is Nick?
Who is Nick? Yeah, I listened to a few of your other podcasts, and so I knew this one was coming. I was like, you know, Nick has changed over the years a bit. You know, I used to define myself purely on, being an ultra runner and doing these big events. And had I answered this question, you know, 5 years ago, Nick was the Nick Nicodemus, you know, Ultra Demus, as I named my little Instagram handle, was the guy who did the world's most difficult events, was the guy who, you know, went and finished a race when everybody dropped out because the weather was just, you know, too horrible for everyone else. And I was the only one left out there, kind of thing. You know, heart surgery kind of changed that for me in 2018, along with, you know, a chronic knee injury that I had throughout most of 2017. You know, Nick these days, I wrote out a set of values, you know, and some of the things in life that, you know, post heart surgery and stuff, when that sort of forced me to change this connection to being this person who's only defined on completing the most difficult things, in the space that left in me, you know, was the discovery of, you know, even if I can't finish the world's most difficult things, I still really value exploring the world. I still really value adventure. You know, my wife would tell you, I really value exploring canyons, climbing on top of rocks, scrambling up things, you know, runs that aren't just, if I have the privilege to, you know, go do a 6 miler on the road or a 6 miler that's all sort of scrambly, climby, half rock climbing type stuff. I really, really, really enjoy that stuff. And then Nick is also a person who really enjoys, you know, the pursuit of education and learning and continuing to learn, whether it's in, you know, school or whether it's through another pursuit of a different hobby or something like that. So, yeah, I've been kind of figuring out what else Nick is since 2018. So, yeah, great question.
Awesome. The hardest events and chasing the hardest events piece is interesting. You specifically noted that you wanted to do things that other people couldn't. Was there some sort of validation you were looking for? What was the, and then you commented that may have changed. Where do you think that came from, that it had to be the hardest or the longest or the worst weather? And you mentioned Barkley and things like that.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, you're spot on with it coming from, and so this is now, you know, you're talking to Nick of 2020, you know, in August or whatever, who's been doing fairly intensive therapy now for 3 years almost. So this is like after a lot of, you know, therapy comes in different acronyms, and this is after a lot of different acronyms that I have this understanding. So, so I guess my My answer to that is running essentially. I'll give you the general answer for it. So I started running in 2000. Well, I started whatever. I did my first marathon at the age of 15, back in 2005, and that was the Rock and Roll Marathon. You know, at that event, I was the youngest person to do it. That was a way to stand out. That was a way to sort of say, hey, mom, hey, dad, please notice me. I'm feeling really invalidated and really neglected and invisible to you guys. You know, I think that was a plea to, hey, please notice me, is what that was back then. I didn't have, because I didn't sort of get the backup. My mom, for better or for worse or whatever, was occupied in her own mind, having gone through a divorce recently and sort of tending to her own needs, you know, just didn't give me quite the attention that I needed back then. And so as a result of that, you know, I found it impossible in my own mind back then to imagine competing with others for the validation, competing with other kids my age in cross country, or competing with other kids my age in track and field, doing what other kids my age would do. But, you know, every other person that was slightly better than me at track or better than me at cross country was basically an enemy or something in my way of getting validation or of getting first place that would maybe finally get my mother's attention or something like that. And so I sort of found a niche in running marathons, you know, at the age of 15 or something like that, because no one else my age was doing that. Badwater at the age of 19, no one else my age was doing that. Arrowhead 135, no one else was doing that or trying to run it hard or whatever it was. Barkley marathons in 2010, 2011, 2012, relatively no one had heard of it still. My time there was 2011, 2012, 2013. And so chasing these events that were on the fringes, more obscure, not stuff like Western States, not stuff like Hard Rock, where, again, similar to cross country or track and field, there was too much competition that would represent sort of a barrier to that, like, external validation that, you know, by the time I was 20, 22, had left my mother, and I'm not trying to get validation from my mother at that point anymore. I'd sort of internalized and learned that, okay, this is how Nicodemus gets validation. This is how Nicodemus gets, you know, feels valid in his existence.
Do you feel it worked for a while?
Yeah, it worked. It worked terrifically. It was one of the best. I mean, you know, what I said earlier with, you know, being a person, and I likened myself a lot at the time to, like, you know, the people I was looking up to was like David Goggins and Charlie Engel and stuff. And I saw a lot of myself in like David Goggins, where it was just like this hard, you know, kind of attitude and just like, yeah, I can tough it out better than everybody else. And I think, you know, different than David, I was driven by that need for external validation from a lack of, you know, love and kindness, essentially, from when I was younger and developing. The best way that I've been able to describe it, Jonathan, is like, I was the kind of guy who you would not want to go to the top of Mount Everest with. Because if I was in your team going to the top of Mount Everest and, you know, okay, we're at the final 3,000 feet of Mount Everest, and oh man, a wicked storm's blowing in. Whoa, we've gotta sit the night out. You know, we've gotta take this cautiously. Screw you guys, I'm going to the top. Because for me, you know, even braving a storm where I could die or whatever, that my life didn't matter so much as that validation mattered so much more than like the potential safety or anything like that. Does that metaphor make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So as a horrible team player, and that played out in a race in 2015 where I tried to be on a team, but that's a different story.
For sure. So where was the breaking point?
Good question. So the sort of breaking point for this, and what kind of began my journey with this and realization of, oh, everyone else isn't like this. Oh God. was, you know, I mean, cause like, had I just kept, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, being successful, or relatively successful in the sport, you know, you would have just continued to see me just do weird fringe races or make up my own categories and things like that. Right. The breaking point was essentially in 2017 in November. It was like November 23rd. I'd learned that I had a 5.1 centimeter aneurysm in my heart, and that needed surgery sometime soon. I didn't know exactly when. I'd just gotten married to my wife a month before. That marriage, though, had caused my mom had sort of like fully abandoned me after getting married, and sort of just, I don't know, wrote sort of my wife and I off after our marriage at that time. So I had some deep emotions going on there. I had also chronically had a knee injury for about 2 years. You actually won't see because I didn't write crap about it, but I'd write, you know, prior to 2017, extensive race reports on like, you know, Cruel Jewel or whatever it was. And I did Dragon's Back over in England in 2017 and just had an absolute, this is just a short aside, and then I'll get to the breaking point. Just, I remember calling Jade at the finish of that, and Jade's my wife, and crying to her at the end of it. And this is a 5-day stage race with like 300 kilometers or something like that, a bunch of gain, a bunch of weird hills, self-navigation type thing. And just crying to her on the phone at the end of it, just sort of like, what the hell was the point in that? Why was I out here? And I'd like landed in sixth place, and I felt so worthless and so like just devoid of value because I was sixth place and no one was going to notice me and no one was going to care. And it was just such a waste of effort for me. And that sort of shows that, again, what we were talking about earlier, that sort of, one could call it sort of an addiction to the external validation that I was otherwise getting. And, you know, I had tried my hardest, but with the knee injury that I'd had, I wound up sixth place. And that was that. And so that was sort of going around. I had nothing to show for myself now at this point in 2017. I had some sponsors at this point that I felt like I was just letting down because, again, Nick was the guy who went out and, you know, crushed the world's hardest races and won them and set course records on them, or that's at least what I told myself, right? And so that was bubbling in my head. I just got married. My mom had kind of, in a sense or another, abandoned me. And then I found out I had an aneurysm that I needed to get a heart surgery on sometime soon. And so there was a marital argument about, I don't know what the heck Jade and I were arguing about. I remember feeling like an absolute horrible burden, just totally worthless. I'd be better off dead. And so we lived in Coronado, and there's a bridge there where unfortunately a lot of people commit suicide there. Didn't visit the bridge, but I did go to the bay. And I just fully in my clothes, put my wallet and keys on a table there, assuring myself that I would come back for it. And then just walked into the ocean fully clothed and swam out about half a mile, and then tried drowning myself several times. Came up coughing a bunch of water and crap, and just decided that it was a little too hard to kill myself that way, at least. And then the cold water by then had sort of shocked that feeling out of me. But it was around then that I started to believe Jade that, you know, okay, maybe, you know, maybe I do need to go see a therapist and start to get some of this kind of figured out, because something's wrong here.
Yeah, that's powerful. I had a conversation with my own therapist last week, and we were talking about my childhood, and I was a pretty angry little kid. I don't know why, but I had, I don't want to say similar experiences, but similar statements were made by first grade me. And it's, do you ever think back on, like, can you believe that that was the same person that you are today?
Thinking back to the version of me that was so addicted to winning, or the version of me that tried to drown himself in the ocean?
More the latter.
Yeah. Unfortunately, through 3 years of therapy, things have been up and down. It's more been it's been a very difficult process. It's been a very much oh God, ultra running was the only source of external, was the only source, for worse of my character or whatever, from the age of 15 onwards, always being in a relationship. And so it was relationships and ultra running were my two sources of validation and senses of worth. And so, being married now and learning to develop intimacy, which is extremely difficult for me, and then two, having we could talk about Speed Goat, which I went out to with Jade a week and a half, 2 weeks ago or whatever, but again, being able to go to those events now, and not that I stand a chance anyways, even in my earlier days against Hayden Hawks and those guys,
he's on another level these days.
Yeah, the whole sport's on enough. I mean, those were the races anyways in the first place that I eschewed, because I was nope. I'm gonna go do my weird thing at the mountain. Just having that sense of external validation totally plucked away from me. To answer the question, long story short, can I imagine myself still in that place where I went and drowned myself in the ocean? Yes, very easily. And I fall into that same place. Probably it's happened twice so far this year. When it happens, it doesn't go as far, and I have more tools, and I have a therapist, and I'm not afraid of calling the suicide hotline. And I'm kind of okay with calling a friend or two or something like that in the moments after. And I realize usually it's an emotion that only lasts about 15 to 20 minutes. So if I can survive 15 to 20 minutes, then I'll likely be okay.
I think that survive 15 to 20 minute analogy or statement is powerful. It's not about, and maybe that's how people get through long runs or long races, breaking up by mile or breaking up into 15 minutes, but sort of zooming out a little bit and saying, I just need to get through this next hurdle. I think that's powerful. So you reached out to me after Alan Scherer's podcast, and you said you appreciated his vulnerability in talking about some similar topics. I wanted to have you on the podcast for the same reason. After that podcast, I got dozens of messages from people saying, wow, I thought I was alone. And hearing his words helped me. It didn't, it didn't make things better, but just hearing that, you're not alone in a struggle like that was helpful. So I think, first, I appreciate your vulnerability and openness to talk about very much so a work in progress, not necessarily a success story. Hopefully
yeah,
that's
not,
coming.
I wouldn't say I'm solved yet. You're calling me. I'm reaching out in the, it was, I thought it was beautiful, man, that you had just, you know, someone like Alan and you guys are just chatting about mental health and ultras and stuff like that. And not at all to say like, you know, other folks are messed up in ultras or whatever it is, or, but just, you know, examining what's out there and examining, you know, our different relationships with the sport. And, man, I thought, you know, 3-4 years ago and, you know, back when I was doing TDG in Italy and stuff like that, I thought I had it all figured out, man. I thought it was just like, yes, yeah, just, this is what you do. And yeah, I'm adventurous and stuff like that. But, know that like, that, you know, addiction to like, no, I've got to win this. I've got to do well. I've got to get noticed. I've got to, you know, in thinking about even stuff like, you know, back in 2014 with Tour de Géance or whatever. And,
do you want to explain what that race is for those that don't know?
Sure. Yeah. It's a 205 miler, out in, Courmayeur, Italy, which is just on the other side of Mont Blanc from, where, Ultra Trail Mont Blanc starts or UTMB starts. So similar range. They share the same course for about 50K or something like that. But 205 miles, 80,000 feet of climbing. It's just 26 giant, huge alpine passes that you do. And in 2014 there, I had a pretty good race there and was second place. I remember being, I had a big sponsor there, European sponsor, at the time, and just remember being like celebrated so much and just that like ephemeral feeling of like, oh my God, I'm being recognized. Yes, this is all I want. This is all I've ever wanted. And it reminded me of times like in college, I would, and this should have been a signal that like, oh man, there's some sort of like hardcore validation lacking in my soul. You know, but I would go on runs. I went to school in Flagstaff, Arizona, and at Northern Arizona University, and you know, no one gave a crap that I was doing, you know, that, oh yeah, I won the Flagstaff Marathon, guys. Or, oh yeah, I did this other 50K and won it. And they're like, dude, we're just having beers. I don't give a crap that you won, man. And so it was just that sort of like, wow, I can't get crap for validation here unless I'm really good at beer pong or something like that. I don't know. And so then I would go on these solo runs at like, I don't know, kind of weird, depressed runs. I don't know what the heck they were, man. I'd get up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. I'd go to the Flagstaff Forest and, you know, just kind of go out there with my thoughts. And then at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning, watching sunrise, which is all cool and stuff. But I remember getting these chills and getting what I thought were like runner highs when I think about like how good it would feel to be famous, how good it would feel to be recognized, how good it would feel to, you know, make it in some article or hit some big sponsor finally. And I should have like, well, now looking back on that stuff from this perspective, I see that like, wow, that there's a kid who was really desperate for love and attention, who was really, really lacking in that. And so anyways, long story short with TDG is, you know, I finally had that there. And then, I remember like 2 weeks after the race, when I returned back to the United States and back to my job in Southern California, I was living with my parents or whatever post-college. And, I was, listing comic books on eBay and just listing used comic books on eBay or whatever in my parents' garage. And, it made some money, and I'd find myself, you know, I'd go over to, Goodwill and stuff, and I'd look for, you know, like a Pyrex container or something like that to go flip on eBay or whatever it was. And, but just the juxtaposition between that and all the attention, that I'd had in Italy and now, you know, no one knew me or anything like that. And because TDG was sort of a fringe European race, no one really knew or cared about it. You really had to sort of explain it in the United States. I remember that just like hurting my ego a ton, for how hard I had worked and how little, attention it had garnered, I guess, again, in the United States. And again, this all harkens back to like, I may be coming across as like, oh man, this guy's just ego media hungry or whatever. But, the explanation there is really, you know, this is all driven from, just that need, that desire for external validation.
Why'd you get out of bed today?
Oh man, my wife got up. No. Shoot. That's a good question. When I think deeply about that one, you have me here, Jonathan, and definitely like a middle of whatchamacallit, like the middle of even like signing on the podcast here is like, man, I don't know what motivational crazy thing I'm gonna talk about. Like, where's my like motivational crazy thing I'm gonna talk about? And like give everybody this like nice little package.
But it's not that. That's not what people are looking for. And no, listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah, I think people are looking for relatability, and they're looking to hear other humans talk about the human experience. And there's nothing more human than sharing struggle. And it's not to, you know, put you on you know, some sort of like, hey, look at this guy. But it's more about let's listen to somebody who, yeah, let's humanize it and understand that everybody is. Megan Roche said something on the podcast that I did with David and Megan, and they were quoting Vonnegut. And
cool.
So Megan says, we're here to help each other get through this thing, whatever it is. And David reframed that, we're here on Earth to fart around and don't let anyone else tell you different.
I was just going to say, that's the quote of Vonnegut that I know best.
Right. The first one, I mean, I totally agree with the second one. I love just farting around. But the first one is, I mean, that's why I love having this platform, so that I can share these experiences with other people who are going through things and need to hear that other people are going through things as well.
Yeah. No, for sure. So, I really appreciate that and agree with that first quote as well. To answer the question then, I guess, I mean, just being frank and honest, probably anxiety. Probably slightly this morning, a sense of worthlessness, and I've got to prove myself, and I've got to get my, you know, I'm a running coach. I've got to get my athletes done. I've got to provide the best schedule. I've got to provide this. Oh, I've raised my rates recently, and oh man, I'm not worth it. They're gonna find out I'm a worthless piece of crap, and I gotta get going, and I gotta prove myself. So that's instantaneously what gets me out of bed. And then it's a sort of a matter of quieting that and immediately using dialectical behavioral therapy skills to quell that before those thoughts start taking the driver's seat.
Do you find that helping someone else achieve their goal is helpful for you in the coaching athlete relationship?
For sure. Yeah.
How'd you get into coaching? Or sorry to cut you off there.
The first question was just if it sort of helps me psychologically focus on someone else. And the answer, absolutely. I'll sort of liken it to, like, you know, if you're feeling that like really strong, just think about it, like, you know, if like you're feeling like horrible stage fright or something like that, and it's the dread before you step up on the stage that really is the worst intolerable feeling or whatever it is, you know. So like before I have a phone call with an athlete or something like that, you know, the 30 minutes before, even before this podcast, there's like 30 minutes before of, oh crap, am I going to do this right? Am I going to get this right? I don't have anything prepared. Jonathan's going to think I'm an idiot. And then, you know, once I'm on the call or once I'm talking with the athlete, my focus is on, you know, either your questions in this case, or my focus is on entirely 100% on that athlete. And so it takes me totally out of my own space, totally out of my own head. It gets me out of my head, which running used to do. And a lot of people assume that, you know, running does that. But when you've been running for 10 plus years, there's a lot of crazy negative thoughts that can definitely invade your head because you're very used to it. So anyways,
So what got you into coaching?
So what got me into coaching? My wife, basically. So it was in that moment in Goodwill, back in San Diego, where I was like 2014 or something like that, maybe. I was doing some group classes with a company down in San Diego, and I'd worked as a personal trainer. I don't know. I was like, oh, come on, Gene, we're going to go to a thrift store and I'm going to show you how to pick up some products and flip some products and stuff. And, we were looking for Pyrex containers, cause you buy them for $1 and flip them for like $9. And so we were looking for those at the Goodwill. And, I just kind of looked at her after I'm picking up some plastic Tupperware and she's like, man, what am I doing with my life? And I kind of felt like I was, you know, and it's a great way to make money. And I've made a fair bit of money doing that on the side for things at times. But
9x ROI is pretty good.
Yeah, man. I was just thinking like, man, this is not, I think, what I want to do with my life. And Jade had mentioned coaching for a long time, or had been mentioning it for the last year at that point. And I had just, you know, for the longest time up until when I finally gave it a go in 2015 is when it was, was again, back to that like sort of worthlessness. Well, what do I have to offer? What does anyone want from me? What would I be giving anyone? Kind of thing had sort of held me back from ever giving it a go. So it just launched into it finally and just, you know, made it a lucky 13 coaching, which was, you know, based off of, being the 13th finisher of the Barkley marathons and stuff, which is a cool name and all. And I'm happy with it. Jade and I are eventually gonna, similar to the Roaches, conjoin our businesses and stuff, and give it a different name. But, that's what it is. And that was sort of the formation of it and stuff.
Cool. Thanks again to John G for sponsoring this episode. As a runner, you know the importance of hydration, but you might not know that almost 800 million people lack access to drinking water. By working together, we can create viable solutions, and collectively, we can have a greater impact. The John G Collective is one way to do that. It's a membership that earns you a ton of perks like discounts on gear and first access to new collections. It's also a community of adventurous runners around the world. 100% of the membership fee goes towards supporting clean water programs. I'm a member and enjoy knowing that it is a small step that each of us can take that when pooled together can have quite an impact. It's also great knowing that once the world reopens, I'll have runners in almost every city to enjoy a run with when I'm on the road in a new place. If you use the code FTLR, like for the long run, you can join the John G Collective for $50. You'll receive a free singlet as well as a special members-only discount for life. Every dollar from that will go towards supporting clean water programs. I hope you'll join me. So I read an article about you and Jade, and it was in I Run Far. And one of the quotes is talking about raising awareness about mental illness and destigmatizing therapy. It says, running can be a part of healing, but for many, if not most cases, it can't take the place of actual therapy. You continue to say, in your case, you believe that running can be abused in an unhealthy manner, and can sort of cover up other things. So this is a statement or a platform that I've stood on as well. I've said running can be a form of therapy, but it can't replace therapy as a form of therapy. So I guess I have a couple of questions here. First, what motivated you to seek out therapy? What was the, where did that come from?
So the motivation to seek out therapy essentially, and, I'm glad that you're glad that you found that article. It was basically, I was a month into my marriage with Jade. I'd nearly just drowned myself in the ocean. I wanted to drown myself in the ocean, and just this intense feeling of worthlessness and I don't matter. And I guess just at that point, prior to that, you know, I'd come from a family that didn't believe in medication, didn't believe in mental illness, didn't believe in therapy or anything like that. And so it was psychologically, like, even going to the therapist, of course, was, you know, God damn, I'm so weak. I'm such a piece of shit for having to do this, man. Oh God, you know, why can't I just get over my own shit and just suck it up and just move the hell on. And every time I went to, you know, a therapist, and then went to, you know, a psychiatrist, and then eventually got a medication to go on, and then I got a psychological evaluation done. And then this last, February or January, going to an inpatient clinic. And just each layer that I went down was still that recurrent shame of, God, man, Nick, you are such a failure, for having to do this kind of thing. And of course, you know,
that's, you think that's, that was society? You think that was society?
Society, and it's growing up in a family that, you know, didn't ever, whether it was society that taught my family that, or whether it was, you know, my family's own miniature culture. Whatever it was just, having to constantly jump over that hurdle with each layer that I went into it. I'm pretty used to it now.
So yeah, the balance of running as therapy and therapy as therapy is definitely important. I think you can get some version of moving meditation through running. But I think that they sort of need to be decoupled if you're actually looking for progress, like it sounds like was the case for you. So let's talk about destigmatizing therapy. Here we are, two guys talking about therapy. It's, you know, not something that you see every day or hear every day. What motivated you to, so you've talked about what motivated you to do it, but what's motivated you to talk about it? And like, you reached out because you said you wanted to talk about it and you wanted to have this conversation. So where does that come from for you?
Man, I think, you know, just being totally frank with you on it again, to a point of like, okay, I have nothing to hide. I think, you know, it's part of a new identity in some ways, you know, it's a weird thing, right? Like, I don't want to say I identify with, you know, borderline personality disorder, which is one of several acronyms I was given. At the same time, you know, identifying with that, you know, does give you it's not a freaking badge. It sucks. I'm getting distracted from the question here a little bit. What motivated me to be able to talk about this stuff? I don't know. It's sort of a search of like trying to continue to convey, you know, I mean, had you talked to me 5 years ago, it would have been, yes, I'm conveying my authentic self, because my authentic self was, you know, sort of a modest, driven guy who was, you know, trying to win all these races or whatever it was, but I'd never say that. So I guess now talking about mental health and, you know, talking about suicide or drowning myself in the ocean or whatever subject we get onto here is just trying to be the motivation is to present an authentic self, to be vulnerable, kind of like what you were saying, to be yet another person out there in the world talking about, you know, suicide, self-harm, mental illness, and my relationship to the sport. So I guess that's sort of my motivation with that.
Have your role models changed over the last couple of years?
Yeah, definitely.
How so?
Man, I would say, you know, folks who I used to admire a lot, like David Goggins and stuff. And like Charlie Engel, and all that, I would say, you know, just these people who were, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to push through everything and I'm going to, whatever it is, I'm going to finish this race. I'm going to finish the world's hardest challenge or whatever it is. I suffered all these, you know, emotional abuses and crap as a child, but I survived it and I'm tougher because of it. And I'm going to push through this crap now and destroy this race, kind of thing, or destroy this challenge. My role models now and what I value quite a lot more, and it's shifted. If you were coaching with me, if you've coached with me for like one or two athletes these days, coached with me for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, I would say they've certainly seen that shift where, you know, a lot of people were attracted to me originally because of that. Like, oh yeah, I'll get Nick as a coach because he's done this, you know, weird race in Europe that was, you know, super hard or whatever it was. And I want to do the super hard thing. So I'd get these, not risk averse, whatever the opposite of that is, risk-taking athletes, who would want to do these extreme races with a 5% chance of finishing type thing. And, that has shifted a lot, in the respect now of, you know, my people who I look up to, you know, would be someone like, Marsha Linehan or something like that, who's the person who created, dialectical behavioral therapy, who's, you know, really, really phenomenal psychologist on mindfulness and being able to sit with emotions and not react to emotions and stuff. And so I've had a fascinatingly fun time getting to know my athletes at a deeper relationship in many ways, getting to even use some of those tools in sort of a very light manner with ultra running. For example, you know, one of the DBT skills, dialectical behavioral therapy, would be something like, what is it called? It's a observe, right? And so observe is one of the skills. And the way I sort of translated it into a skill you can use while ultra running is, let's say, you know, you're mile 60 of 100 miler and, you know, the next aid station or the next aid station's coming up in 5 miles, but you're 15 minutes ahead of the cutoff time and you come up to a trail intersection and it's not marked. And what I want you to do in that moment is, or in the moments leading up to that, is you can tap your left thigh to notice a feeling. You can tap your stomach to notice a thought. And then you can tap your right leg to notice an action or an observation or a tangible, something that you tangibly felt, right? So feelings, I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling bad. I'm feeling fearful. I'm feeling inadequate. I'm feeling like a failure. My thoughts, oh, I'm never going to make this. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to get this. This time's coming up. Okay, the action urges are, I want to move fast. I want to do this quickly. I want to get through this quickly. I got to move. I got to go. Right. And so if you can kind of see what those are by tapping those different parts of your body, you can then be like, okay, well, that action urge is telling me to go, but I need to do something very careful here. That is actually another DBT skill, opposite action or opposite to emotion action. So that emotion is fear, anxiety, and so then the opposite action to that emotion, the emotion being fear and anxiety, would be calm, or would be an action that incorporates calm and a relaxed mood. So the thing to do in that situation would be to, you know, pull out your phone, pull out your GPS, pull out your map or whatever it is, refer to the map, take 5 breaths, take even a minute, 2 minutes, even though you only have 15 minutes to calm your body, calm your heart rate down. Then make the decision. If I had known something like that in Barclay 2012, I would have finished then. yeah.
Is gratitude something you practice? You sort of alluded to it a little bit a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
How does that work into your day-to-day?
Yeah, I got a little, I bought it at like a Barnes & Noble, I think. It's called 2-Minute Mornings. So sitting next to me, I could read you ones from it. There's 3 questions you ask yourself in the morning. I will let go of blank. I am grateful for blank. I will focus on blank. So I'll choose a random day for you. December 4th, 2019. I will let go of low self-worth behaviors. I am grateful for this morning's bike ride and tights that I felt I looked good in. Time to work, to relax. Meatloaf, who's my rabbit, and his furriness. An excellent fluffy egg breakfast that I made, and a good night's sleep. I will focus on doing what is effective, one mindfulness, and curiosity. That's just an example of it. But yeah, and then gratitude, of course, in running itself is an excellent, when you talk about an emotion that is opposite to anxiety, fears, and things like that. If you can flip on and focus on, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be out here in this race. I have a hard time genuinely connecting with it, to be honest. Again, just being frank with you. But gratitude's one I do try and practice a lot. It's one I have a hard time feeling a genuine connection to.
Got it. Yeah, I think it's an evolving practice. I think that it's something that feels maybe a little fake at first, and as you practice it more, it can be real and it can be a powerful reflection.
Have you broken through the? I still get stuck on the fakeness with it. Have you
yeah.
broken through?
Yeah, Amelia Boone is a good friend of mine, and for a long time she was doing every morning she would write 10 things she was grateful for. And back when I could go to a gym, I would, when I was sitting in the sauna, this was something I would do. I would normally do this at the end of the day, so it wasn't morning gratitude, but it was evening gratitude. And I would sort of go through 10 things that I was appreciative of in that day. And at first it felt like, just checking the boxes, like my health and my family and my blah, 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 blah. And like, but then you start picking out these like little minute details of things that you appreciate and things that you like about what you did in that day or a conversation you had. And it's less about these big boulders and more about the little pebbles that add up to making boulders or something larger. But for me, I've been able to apply it more to running in particular. Both when I'm healthy, like now, or when I'm injured, like earlier this year. Because my feeling is, in this moment now, I'm grateful for the ability to, run 16 miles or 10 miles or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. When I was injured, I was thinking about how awesome it would be to not be injured and like how great, like I had a run last weekend or the weekend before. It was marked on my schedule 16 easy. And I texted David 12 miles in. I was like, dude, I feel so good. Can I go longer? And he said, no, of course. And I finished the 16 miles and it was like almost effortless. Like one of those runs that like we dream of and that we train for.
That's cool, man.
And so it was like in that moment and the rest of that day, I was like, this is what I'm so grateful to be able to experience. Like that is a feeling that you cannot get with a drug. You can't get that with, there's no replacement for that euphoria. You just have to earn it. And it doesn't happen on your first run. It doesn't happen on your 10th run, but it comes from consistency. And so in that moment, I was very grateful of like the process and the ability to get to that moment.
That's cool, man. No, that's super cool. That's super cool that you were able to connect with that. I think what you're saying too, with just the work that you did with gratitude earlier in the time when you were injured, I think is that's like to me almost bigger than the work that you did like during the during the time when you're uninjured. But it sounds like that work that you've been consistently doing with gratitude enabled you to, if I'm understanding it, enabled you to, I guess, appreciate and really see the value the value in that good 16 miler that you had versus like,
yeah, I think all of it's a work in progress and sort of a, I had a coach who explained it as like, you're always stacking bricks and your bricks are building your house of fitness. But the more, you know, as life goes on, the more I learned that that's true outside of running too. And it's, these little things add up and slowly these little things become big things as long as you're able to be consistent with it.
I like that phrase. I like that phrase of always stacking bricks. And I like a lot what you said too, with like how it's those, because I could say the same thing, to be honest, but like not getting too off subject from your questions or anything, but just with the whole stacking bricks thing. And like, you know, so the primary thing, you know, when you boil it down to my psychology, I struggle with low self-worth. And with that or whatever, you know, having gratitude or whatever for, you know, something I did that day, clients that I worked with that day, something I accomplished, the spackle that I'm going to put on the ceiling so I can install a plant in my ceiling, you know, whatever it is, or if I cook a good dinner or something like that. And if I can be proud of that or have gratitude for that, those are little tiny bricks that slowly increase my self-worth over time. Yeah, no, it's good stuff.
For sure. So one of the other, I guess the last question I have for you is, so David and Megan use a phrase, you are enough. And it's in their book. It's sort of the vibe that they give off in the social media world. And so I want to know, when you hear a statement like that, as someone who has explained, sometimes you don't feel like you are, what does that mean to you when somebody tells you, you are enough?
It's a difficult one. And I want to answer this honestly without being too much of a Debbie Downer or anything like that. it's tough, right? I mean, like if it actually hits me, so the two core things a person with a BPD suffers with is, my emotions, my feelings, my thoughts don't matter and are worthless. Therefore, I am worthless. And you believe that to a core because you were ingrained with that since inception to, you know, present day. And so when you say you are enough, what happens to me personally is that you hit a sort of force field of numbness and I feel nothing when you say that. And then I sit with that a little bit longer, I start to feel kind of angry, and there's some anger there. And that anger, without turning this into a therapy session, you know, is at the fact that love and attention and being told that I was enough was never there for me when I was, you know, growing up and a baby and everything. And then if you dig underneath that, I'll probably cry. Right now in this podcast, we're staying in the numb world. But that's just kind of where that one hits me. Just being honest with you.
Got it. Again, I appreciate the honesty and candidness. What is one thing that you're excited about this year?
Oh man. I love the change of subject. That one's, I gotta like dig myself out of the little hole there, man. I get dark quick on that one. It's been a weird year. It's been, you know, obviously for everybody. COVID's been strange. It's been such a weird mix of like, well, do we travel? If we travel, do I feel bad for traveling? And then just all sorts of like weird, I don't know. So man, looking forward to still. I mean, we just got back from a trip. We were just over in the San Juan Mountain Range. So I'm kind of like, we just got back on Saturday. So I'm kind of still riding a high from, you know, going and running around like Engineer Pass and some of, I guess, what's the Hard Rock course and stuff. And just being all among the wildflowers there. And so just, I don't know, kind of just looking forward to, you know, relaxing week back at home here in Sedona. It's a lovely, lovely place to be. So yeah.
Sedona must be beautiful this time of year.
It's awesome, man. Yeah. It gets a little toasty and stuff like that. And since living here in March, it's a constant battle between us and the wild pigs they have here called the javelina that they like to eat our garden.
So that's why it's called the javelina. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's called.
Now that race makes sense.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
I had a wild experience with some wild pigs or wild boars in Israel. And, those things are nasty.
Yeah, dude, they're vicious, man.
Wow. Yeah. That's not a good memory. Well, again, I really appreciate you opening up and sharing your story. What are some, for those listening, who might be, whose your story might be resonating with, what are one or two resources you might recommend somebody checks out?
So, one of my favorite people, whether, dealing with mental illness or not, I really like Kristen Neff's work. So she wrote, she's sort of the head person of what's called the mindfulness self-compassion movement, which we talked about gratitude and stuff. Self-compassion would be sort of a close cousin or something like that of gratitude. But Kristen Neff, mindfulness, self-compassion, puts out some really, really great stuff. I've really enjoyed, as well, just in terms of mental health stuff, Neil Glassman's Wake Up, Wind Down thing that he does through Spotify. I don't know if anyone wants to check that out, but it's just a super short little podcast he does in the morning and the afternoon. I like his Irish voice. I find it relaxing.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I'd say, you know, those two nice, simple resources out there. Kristen Neff puts out a lot of free stuff, which is cool.
Awesome. I'll try and link to all that. And thank you so much for coming on to chat today.
Absolutely, Jonathan. Yeah, thank you again so much for having me. Wonderful, wonderful to talk with you and everything.
That's it for today's episode. Like many long runs, it's sad when it has to end. I hope you join in next week on For the Long Run. And in the meantime, happy trails. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would mean a lot to me if you shared it so that others can find it and enjoy it too.